Hi, this is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and I want to welcome you to this week's weekly podcast. We are getting down to the end of this series on the active nonviolence of Jesus. And this week we're going to be diving into part 8. We're going to begin with the thought text in Matthew 5:44, where Jesus says, "But now I tell you, love your enemies." This week, I want to address what I think is the single greatest objection to the peace teachings of Jesus that I get. The question is raised almost every time that Jesus' teachings on nonviolence are beginning to be taken seriously. And the question is, well, Herb, what would you do if someone broke into your home? And rather than beginning with the emotions of this worst-case scenario first, I want to begin with the actual teachings of Jesus and work our way back out to its application, especially in regards to this question this week. I believe the answer is found in Jesus' actual teachings in Matthew chapter 5. I also want to recommend that you go back and reread part 3 of this series as a foundation to what we're going to be sharing this week. Jesus' answer is right there in part 3, but I also want to recommend a very small volume that is, in my opinion, one of the best little books written on this subject. It's by John Howard Yoder, and it's called What Would You Do? It's a quick read, but one of the most excellent writings on this subject that I've come across. Now, in answer to the above question, I want to make it clear. From the very beginning, I don't know what I would do until I'm faced with this situation, but I do know what I should do, and this is where we begin this week. Whenever we discuss this question, I have witnessed that there seems to be a lot of binary thinking on this matter. And I mean by this that usually someone only perceives two options. Either you pick up a gun and shoot the invader, or you do nothing. But there's a multitude of other creative, nonviolent options when one stops to consider what could happen. Besides this, studies also show that when you add either a gun, an initial gun, or an additional gun, statistically, it raises the odds that the outcome is going to be the exact opposite of what you would think it would. It's going to go very negatively, even more negatively than it would have otherwise. Nothing's guaranteed, but statistically, that's what happens. Things do not always go the way we plan in these situations, and we assume that if we pick up a gun, that the outcome will be they lose and we win. But statistics show the exact opposite, and sometimes they win to even a worse degree than what they would have in the beginning. But nowhere, this is the point, nowhere in Jesus's teachings in Matthew 5 did he ever encourage a do-nothing passive response. In Matthew 5, he gives us third option ways of doing things that are nonviolent but still are a response. Love demands that we do something to protect our loved ones, but it also dictates the form that something takes, given that Jesus also died for the invader as well as those you're trying to protect. Jesus' death for the invader makes them, no matter how much we don't like it, it makes them a sacred creature in need of being rescued just as much as those the intruder is threatening. The intruder is simply a conduit at this moment. Let me explain what I mean by this. Paul wrote in his letter to the Ephesians, "For our struggle is not against enemies of blood and flesh, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers of this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in heavenly places." Again, that's Ephesians 6, verse 12. This means that not only do those being threatened need rescued from this attacker, but the attacker himself is not the enemy either, but a victim themselves of the real enemy. They're just a conduit of the real enemy's activity, and they are actually in need of being rescued just as much as those that they are intending to harm. To illustrate this, Martin Luther King Jr. often spoke of all the ways that racism affects the racist themselves. He saw them too as fully and tragically human, God's children, victimized themselves by the evil system that they perpetuated. He taught that every kind of evil cripples the persecutor as well as the victim, and both are dragged down by the same process. And as long as that process continues, they are tied together. Whatever happens to one happens to both. And then Martin Luther King warned, "Let no man pull you so low as to hate him." To be honest, this week, I'm with King on this one. I do believe Jesus really meant it when he taught, love your enemies. Too many times we look at intruders as someone we don't know, as valueless or meaningless. But I want you to imagine an intruder standing in your home, pulling back his ski mask, so to speak, and you realize that it's actually one of your own children. Would your feelings be different? Would your response to that intruder take a different form now that you know it's one of your kids? I would submit that the answer is yes. Now, yes, you would still stop them from hurting your other loved ones, but you wouldn't do it in a way that also that ended their life. You would do it in a way that also preserved their life, and therefore the hope of their redemption as well. You see, no matter who the intruder is, this is still a child of God, someone that Jesus died for, a sacred creature that you've been called to reach out to and try and save as well. Again, what would you feel towards this intruder if they were your child? Whatever you would feel, that's what God feels towards them since they are His child. And God is seeking to save both the victims and the victimizers in this war-torn world of ours. Now, let me share with you a few stories this week. Some of them are hard to get your head around, but I think they'll be helpful in at least discussing this topic. The first one is from a Mennonite follower of Jesus who was once asked if an intruder broke into his home and for a split moment laid down his gun. Would he pick it up and use it? And the Mennonite's response, I think, is just shocking. It's just amazing. The question was, what would you do in that moment? And the dear Mennonite said something that once again challenges me. He said he would drop to his knees and pray, because through prayer he was connecting himself with someone much more powerful than that gun. That's just something to stop and ponder. A pastor friend of mine also tells the story, which I believe helps illustrate this as well. One day on the streets of Toronto, while in conversation with another individual, he notices an African-American woman tear past him, running as if she's scared for her life. Now, the only reason I mention she's African-American, you'll understand in a moment, it's part of the story. But moments later, a gang of skinheads goes racing past in pursuit. And my pastor friend immediately dropped the conversation, began chasing after them. And the whole time he's thinking, I'm a pacifist. What on earth can I do if I catch up to them? But as he rounds the corner, right in front of him is this woman huddled on the ground, surrounded by these men who are kicking her with blows that are aimed to kill. And he did the only thing he knew to do. He hurled himself through the crowd, threw himself on top of this dear lady to interpose himself between her and her attackers. And then he shouted out something that today he says was probably the most stupid thing he could have said. He shouted out, "I'm a follower of Jesus, and that means I can't do two things." And then they all stopped. Silence came over all of them, and my pastor friend then continued, "I'm a follower of Jesus, and that means I cannot let you kill her. But I'm a follower of Jesus, so that means I cannot fight you back." And the crowd then became confused. They began to look at each other, and then they turned their venom on him, saying things like, "Man, what are you doing? You're a whitey." And then they began to argue among themselves, "Do we kill him too? What do we do?" And the crowd began to argue until someone spoke up that it was taking too long, and they became concerned with their own vulnerability now, and so they all began to just disperse. It was nonviolent, but it wasn't intervened. That's the word. He intervened, and he was able to save her life. Once again, Jesus never taught us to do nothing, but he did teach us the form that our something is to take. Calvary itself is the clearest example of that. We'll talk about that in a moment. Again, love demands we do something, but it also dictates the form that that something should take. An Australian friend of mine who wrestling with the same issue came to this conclusion that, and this was a quote from him, he said, God could have taken the devil out in the very beginning, saving millions from him, but God took a different tact. This is undeniably one of the greatest problems people have with God. Why did he not kill Lucifer? Why did he permit Lucifer to live? And though I don't, and these are his words, and though I don't have all the answers, the fact that God didn't just pick up the gun and blow Lucifer away at the very minimum speaks volumes to me. As we close this week, I want us to consider the story of Peter and his defense of Jesus, whom he thought was defenseless. His heart was in the right place, and being in the right place, he sought to protect the one that he loved. That, there was nothing wrong with that. That, by no means, is there anything wrong with. Yet the form that that protection took warranted one of the strongest rebukes given by Jesus to anyone in the Gospels. This is taken from Matthew 26, Mark 4, Luke 22, and John 18. Suddenly, one of those with Jesus put his hand on his sword, drew it, and struck the slave of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Remember, he was aiming for his head. The guy just ducked. Then Jesus said to him, "Put your sword back into its place. No more of this, for all those who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels?" Now, someone may object at this point, saying, "Yeah, but Jesus was supposed to die. With us, it's different." But I would humbly remind us of the words of Jesus himself. The cross was not something Jesus was to die instead of us. Jesus was not to be unique as the cross bearer. He was simply the first, being an example of which his followers were to follow. This is from Luke 9, 23 through 24. Then he said to them all, if any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves, take up their cross daily, and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will save it. Look at John 12. 23 and 26, Jesus answered them, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Very truly, I tell you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains just a single grain. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Those who love their life will lose it. Those who hate their life in this world will keep it for eternal life. Whoever serves me must follow me. And where I am," and remember that was being hung on a Roman cross, "there will my servant be also. Whoever serves me, the Father will honor." This is Matthew 10:38. "Whoever does not take up the cross and follow me is not worthy of me." Matthew 16:24, Jesus told his disciples, "If any man wants to be my followers, let him deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me." Mark 8:34, he called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me." Luke 14:27, the last one, "Whoever does not carry the cross and follow me cannot be my disciple." Now, again, this is not a sit back, do nothing, let others be hurt, but it is a desire to intervene to save both the perpetrator and those being threatened. Even at the sacrifice of oneself rather than the perpetrator if need be. As followers of Jesus, we are called in all of our doings to lay down the sword and to pick up in its place the cross. We are to be living demonstrations, not of the perpetrator sacrificing love of God, but of the self-sacrificing love of God. What would I do if someone actually broke into my home? I don't know the answer to that, and I won't know until it actually happens. But I know that whatever I would do, what I'm called to do is to respond in a nonviolent way that seeks to save not just those who are in immediate danger's way, but to save each person who's involved from being victimized by this event, both those that are threatened as well who's the conduit of the threat. Now, some will say, but we have no guarantee that that will work. And two things I want to say in response to that. Picking up an additional gun doesn't guarantee that either. We think it gives more of an advantage, but again, statistics show that to be utterly false. Statistics show that what really happens is not an increase in the odds that things will turn out for the better, but an increase in the odds that things will turn out much worse than what otherwise would have been. And lastly, as a follower of Jesus, we don't embrace nonviolence, non-lethal force, because it always works, but because nonviolent, self-sacrificial love, even toward our enemies, is what we are called to and commanded by our Lord Jesus. Again, Jesus taught us, but now I tell you, love your enemies. We're called to protect our loved ones, but also recognize the inestimable, unmeasurable, infinite worth that every human being has in the heart of God, regardless of what they're doing at this present moment. They are someone Jesus died for. They're a sacred creature whom we're called to save just as much as we save our loved ones. We're called to love both. Next, we'll discuss two objections that are combined in next week's podcast. This week, keep living in love, thinking like Christ, living like Christ, serving like Christ, and loving like Christ. I love you guys. We'll see you next week.